I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Claire Fuller's new book, Hunger and Thirst, is a thriller and gothic horror novel. But don't let that scare you too much. It's creepy, but primarily in an atmospheric sense. The story follows Ursula, an adult recollecting an incident that occurred when she was 16 years old, living in England's care system. Young Ursula is befriended by Sue, who has a reputation for being a bit of a wild child. Around the same time, Ursula moves into a deserted house with a particularly creepy history. The events that unfold in that house haunt her for the rest of her life. Here's our conversation. So I saw Hunger and Thirst described as a psychological thriller and a gothic horror novel. And I just want to be sure we avoid any spoilers. Is there a brief overview of the book that we can share with our listeners?
It's about Ursula, who is a reclusive and famous sculptor. She is being hounded by a true crime documentary maker about disappearance from 1987. And back in 1987, when Ursula is 16, she meets unpredictable, wild child Sue, who dares her to do various things, which get worse and worse, until finally she dares Ursula to kill someone. And when she actually does, Ursula is haunted for the rest of her life.
When we meet Ursula at 16 years old, she's desperately looking for a place she fits in, a family of her own. Following her first dinner with Sue's family, she thinks, I watched this family as I dried the plates and cutlery, thinking I could easily fit into the bickering, the disagreements, the laughter, the singing. One more daughter would make no difference, surely. So can you talk about Ursula's search for a family?
Yeah, so Ursula, she was with her mother, a single parent, until she was seven, and then her mother dies in very difficult circumstances when they're both in Morocco, which does leave Ursula with lots of trauma. But from then on, she is put into children's homes, foster care. She's kind of bounced from one place to another. And so she really is looking for family, for a place to belong, for a place to call home, something that she has decided upon herself, that she's not, that she's been placed somewhere. And maybe that's her downfall. I'm not sure.
You know, I noticed a debate of sorts in the background of the story. Offhand remarks or prejudgment about someone raised in the foster care program or through adoption versus being raised by natural parents. And I put the natural in quotes. You can't hear me do that. There was definitely a stigma attached to the former. And in fact, when Ursula is at Sue's for dinner, Sue's mother, Anita, comments that while none of the fathers are still around, she still has all of her children with her. What did you want to explore here?
I wanted to explore the prejudice that children brought up in care. We say care over here. I think you say kind of foster care to encompass it all. But for us, care is children's homes. Foster care is when you're placed with a family. But either way, there is some stigma. But I have not been in that system. So it was really important to me that I got it right. And so I did find some people who had been through that system in various ways. So whether they were children who had been brought up in care in the 70s and 80s, or some cases even earlier, foster parents, social workers, one person was a manager of a children's home. And I interviewed them all about their stories, their backgrounds, none of which is Ursula's story. I made up Ursula's story, but I learned some themes from those interviews, one of which is prejudice against people who have been through that system, and some expectations of the kinds of people they are going to be. So they are more likely, this is what people think, to not tell the truth, to exaggerate things, to not be believed. All that kind of stuff was raised in those interviews. And so that's what I was trying to explore in the novel.
There's a scene where, and I believe it was Julie, I could be wrong about this, but Sue's aunt says in an interview for a documentary, Dark Descent, she says, Susie could be the very devil. And then there are hints from other families that Sue is somehow rotten or out of control. But sometimes that impression didn't come through when we talked to Sue. She seemed like a regular teenager, but she seemed vilified by members of her family. What's going on here?
Yeah, I think her aunt sees Sue as someone quite difficult. She is unpredictable and excitable, and she kind of follows her passions. And I think both her mother and her aunt want her to settle down. I mean, this is 1987, and I think those adults who would have been born, 20 years previously are coming from another generation where perhaps women aren't supposed to go out and live their lives and do whatever they want, go where their passion takes them. They are supposed to settle down and have a family and bring in some money. And Sue is not like that. So I think her parents, her mother and her aunt are frustrated by her. You know, of all her siblings, she is the one who's perhaps more fiery, more willing just to go out and do stuff. She's got an older brother, Raymond, who features in the story quite a lot as well. And he has his difficulties, but, you know, he's off to university. He's following a straight path. And Sue is absolutely not. She's just going wherever she wants.
Well, speaking of Sue, there seem to be a lot of secrets in the novel, but not if you told them to Sue, because she spilled everyone's secrets. What did you want to explore with these secrets?
Well, it's a secret in a way that causes the confrontation that happens in the middle of the book, that the second half then follows the consequences of that incident that happens in the middle of the book. And that kind of happens because Sue reveals a secret. Partly that Ursula is actually a very hairy woman. And she's embarrassed by this. And Sue, on one of her good days, actually says to Ursula, "It's fine to be hairy. Don't shave it off. It's part of your body. It's who you are. It's nothing to be ashamed of." So Sue can, on one hand, tell that to Ursula, and then on the other, go and tell her on-off boyfriend Vince that this is the kind of body that Ursula has. And there are huge consequences for Sue revealing these secrets that echo and continue through the years, really. So I suppose maybe the messages, I'm not sure I kind of deal in messages, but, you know, maybe the implication is that if somebody confides in you, somebody who is vulnerable, somebody who isn't used to having such a close friend and trusts you, you should keep those secrets and not reveal them.
You know, somewhat related, what happens when you share one of your secrets but no one believes you? You kind of mentioned a little bit before how people in the care system are often not believed.
Yeah, so Ursula, because she's been brought up in care, is not believed often by official people. But she commits this crime in the middle of the book. She does kill someone and she feels enormous guilt from it. And so she confesses to several people, including the police and her social worker, and she is simply dismissed. She is not believed. I mean, what she confesses is perhaps would be seen as far-fetched. So maybe it isn't surprising, but nobody listens to her, and she has to live with that guilt and the fact that she hasn't been able to confess to anyone for the rest of her life.
You're listening to Marginalia. Our guest today is Claire Fuller, author of the book Hunger and Thirst. So there are a few different themes throughout the book that I'd like to touch on. And if you feel that any of these are spoilers or you don't want to talk to them, just say pass. So the first is the idea of being raised by bears. Ursula is described as bear-like, and her name is Ursula Major, a play on Ursa Major, the bear constellation. And she sculpts a bear as a sculptor later in life. Can you talk to me about bears as a theme?
Well, when I first started this novel in a very, very early draft, I mean, not even a full draft, just kind of the first few pages, I was kind of toying with the idea that Ursula not only could be raised by bears, but could actually be half bear. And in the end, I dismissed that isn't the case. But she does tell a story of having been raised by bears, I think, as an alternative to her real story, which she feels, maybe some shame over. So to create a fictional, ridiculous story, which she thinks no one is going to believe anyway, it just makes her, she thinks, more interesting. And then, of course, as I've said, she is a hairy woman. So, it kind of comes from that. But then she also, in the middle of the book, and I think sometimes onwards from that, she does gain an awful lot of strength. At the beginning of the book, she is almost a victim. She's easily led. She's easily manipulated. She doesn't have an awful lot of agency. Or even when she does, she's led by someone else. But I think by the middle, she suddenly kind of finds her own strength and maybe is more bear-like. I don't know.
What about flies?
There are a lot of flies in this book. In fact, for the launch, the UK launch of Hunger and Thirst, we had a big event in Winchester in Hampshire in the south of England. And we had a competition where people could win my backlist, but they had to guess the number of times the word fly or flies is used in this book. There were some outrageous guesses of thousands, but actually it's 38 times, if you wanted to know. But that really comes from when Ursula is in Morocco with her mother and her mother dies. So she is stuck in a bathroom for 3 days and some nights, obviously. And it's very smelly in there. She's very scared. She feels she can't drink the water. Her mother has told her not to drink the water, otherwise she'll die. And she is very hungry and there are flies in this bathroom. And eventually she manages to catch a fly in her hands and she eats it. It's obviously not going to help her with her hunger, but, she's only 7. She's hoping that it might. And then flies reappear in this novel over and over again, in the same way that there are other kind of symbols and motifs that come back and recur. It's not subsequently really to do with dead bodies and decay. It's to do with the kind of foreshadowing for the reader to know that something is coming. If you hear the buzzing of a fly behind a door, then there's going to be something bad behind the door. So it's a way of raising the dread, I think, in the reader's mind.
I suppose the music from the record and the people humming that same tune has the same role in this book. Do you have that tune in your head?
I do. There was a song that I listened to over and over. Can I remember what it's called? It's by Goldmund, and it's something like The Winter of 1635 to 1636. I think I might have got those years wrong, but it is a very creepy piece of piano music, and I just listened to that really on repeat as I was writing. And yeah, the music works in the same way. As you hear that music, something bad is coming.
So what about the stone baby?
Yes, so this is something that I put in that Sue's aunt has had. And the technical term is a lithopedion. And I can't remember, I think I knew about it before this novel, but it's just something that I was curious about. Sometimes before I start a novel, I will write a list of really random things that I am curious about but don't know very much about, and Some of them make it in the novel, some of them don't, most of them don't. But a lithopedian is when a woman has usually an ectopic pregnancy and the baby remains inside the woman's body and over years calcifies. And I think it can be many, many, many years before it's discovered. Probably not all of them are discovered. Usually they're discovered when the woman has a scan for something else. She's not been aware of this the whole time. And it is a fetus that has kind of turned to stone inside her. And I was just interested in that. And then it seemed to tie in with the other theme in the novel that there's all sorts of things about bodies within bodies and therefore kind of possession. So bodies being possessed by something else. Ursula makes art where the people she's drawing are kind of swallowing someone else. The same with her sculpture. And as you mentioned, she makes this great big carving of a bear, which is slit up the middle. She carves it out of wood. And right in the middle of this bear is a stone woman curled up as though she is a fetus, but she's a grown woman. This is the sculpture that wins Ursula lots of awards. After it's done the rounds of all the galleries around the world, she takes it to a Welsh forest and lets the wood decay so that only the stone woman will remain.
Let's talk about structure. Primarily, we read Ursula's recollection of the past, but occasionally we get a snippet of present moment Ursula, and interstitially, we get pieces of interview that are parts of the fictional documentary, which is titled Dark Descent. How did you determine the best timeline for sharing all of these bits of information with the reader? What does that process of plotting the storytelling look like for you?
Well, I don't plot at all. So I just start with a person, usually in a place, and see where it takes me. It's very kind of organic. I just go with it, try not to worry about it too much. And that whole process might take me a couple of years until I've kind of really got to the end of what this novel is about and start to understand it. And then on the editing, I can then go and check that things happen at the right time. Obviously, I'm doing all the other edits, like looking at character, adding depth to the story, adding description, making sure there aren't plot holes and the themes are right and all those kinds of things. And so checking where things come in the novel is also part of that process. And as you said, some of them are from the actual documentary that is finally made, although not with Ursula's contribution. She refuses. And so I wanted to drip feed those in fairly regularly. So I was kind of looking at where they came to make sure they were spaced far enough apart. But also I was very particular about what interview was happening when, because the reader might work this out, and I'm not too worried if they do, but we don't know who Ursula kills until she kills them. But because there are episodes from the documentary, obviously every time you see an interviewee, the reader is going to know, well, that person isn't dead. So it was important. The order in which they came was really important. But part of the reason for having the documentary in the first place is I started writing it from Ursula's point of view in 1987 when she's 16. But a 16-year-old with very little education is not going to be particularly articulate because it would be written from that current time period. There's not going to be any opportunity for reflection. And so I decided for it to be an older Ursula looking back at when she's 16 so that I can have more possibilities with language and reflection. But then I needed to decide, well, why is she reflecting now? Why? And I thought maybe the police have turned up new evidence or maybe a journalist is investigating something. But then very soon after became clear that it needed to be somebody making a film, because this whole novel is so much about film. So that's kind of why the documentary and how it got dropped in.
One thing I found interesting about these scenes from the documentary, you know, looking at the content of those scenes, they typically captured the moments before the interview, moments that those being interviewed thought were private and wouldn't be shared. What did the viewers of the documentary learn from these moments that were supposed to be private?
Oh, that's a really good question. So I think there are a few things. Firstly, we get to see some of their mannerisms. So perhaps how they settle in their chair, or the fact that they dust, you know, flick some lint off a trouser, perhaps gives us the tiniest of indications of the kind of people they are now, older in life. And we also then get to see where they are, so their surroundings. I was very conscious of what was around these people. Also, I think we get to see a private moment. So it's like the idea of kind of secrets being revealed again, this time to the whole world. I mean, there's nothing terribly revealing in what they do while they're settling into the chair to be interviewed, but it kind of gives an idea of that. And then I don't know anything, or I didn't before I started this novel, about documentary making and true crime documentary making. And so I interviewed a crime documentary maker. She was very revealing about all sorts of things. And then I am a true crime fan. I do watch a lot of it and read it and listen to podcasts. But I started doing it with my writer's hat on. So really beginning to understand how they're edited, how things are cut up, how we as the viewer are being manipulated, what bias are they trying to show us, what are they revealing and what are they holding back. And there are quite a lot of documentaries that show the interviewee settling in before they actually answer the questions. I think it's quite a good technique for perhaps showing a tiny moment of what these people are like before they think they're actually on camera.
You mentioned earlier that film was so important in the book, and this group of young people back in 1987 liked to watch horror movies, and there were so many tropes hinted at throughout this book, and while I wasn't screaming, I was writing in my book with exclamation points, "Don't move into the house that still has belongings of its murderous suicide inhabitants," or "Don't go into the garage," or "You just said it was turning dark, why are you going into the cemetery?" And I say these are tropes, but why do they work so well?
What, generally or in this novel?
Both.
Or both, I don't know. Yeah, I think they work. Why do tropes work? I don't know, there is something within any kind of genre that you're writing that there's some expectation from the reader that these things will be there. And so there's some kind of satisfaction in seeing them. But then also you don't want to use them in exactly the same way. You want to kind of play around with them, have a slightly different version of them. You know, because Ursula watches a lot of horror films, she's really aware of these tropes. And so when they actually start happening to her, there are moments when she actually thinks, and we hear her think, that, oh, this is a trope, I shouldn't go into the haunted bathroom, or I shouldn't open the door when I hear that noise. Or so it was fun to kind of play around with that, and also to play around with horror films that they watch, which are not from the 1980s, they're from the 70s and even the 60s. So the three films that they watch the most are The Shining, Rosemary's Baby, and The Stepford Wives. And I think it's probably no surprise that those three films were novels first, novels that I read before I watched the films. And yeah, it was fun just playing on them. And there are lots of Easter eggs in this novel. So there are some really obvious references to those films. And then there are some much more subtle ones that perhaps people who know those horror films really well will spot. And it's just like a little pleasurable thing for them if they spot it.
Could you see Hunger and Thirst being made into a film?
Yeah, that isn't why I write. You know, I'm writing a novel. But if that happens, you know, three of my other novels have been optioned, but nothing has been made yet. And there's been some interest in this one, but no offers yet. But I would love it to be made into a film. I would absolutely love it. Understanding, because I watch a lot of film, but obviously understanding that it's going to be completely different. You can't turn a novel into a film without rearranging stuff, chopping stuff. But, you know, if the main characters was there, the main idea was there, I think it would be wonderful to see.
The last time we spoke, it was for the novel Swimming Lessons. And now that I've done my research, I know you've written other scary stories, but because I'm coming to this from Swimming Lessons, I didn't realize you had this horror writing in you. Where did this idea for Hunger and Thirst come from?
I have always read dark fiction, and the books I started reading when I was a teenager were horror and ghost stories. So to me, it feels kind of a natural extension of the kind of books I've been writing. But the idea for it really came from, well, it's kind of lots of things come together. But one of the main things was the bungalow that these characters live in was a real bungalow that I lived in 1989, which was full of someone else's possessions. The man had gone off to Australia, decided never to come home. The house was owned by a housing association, and I moved in with all his stuff there, his food in the cupboards, his clothes in the wardrobes, slept in his bed. You know, it's kind of weird. We took the sofa out onto the lawn and left it there, as they do in the book. But there was no haunting in real life. Nothing scary happened. But the house was always a bit weird. And I was a sculptor. I carved in wood and stone in that garage, in that garden. So lots of the things that I experienced, I've put in this book.
What do you want readers to take away from Hunger and Thirst? Or do you have a hope?
Yeah, I guess what I hope is that they will be unsettled, if not scared. You know, it depends on the person, doesn't it? Their level of timidness when it comes to fiction, whether they're going to be scared or whether they're not. There's nothing I can do about that. But I would still want, by the end, someone to be unnerved, unsettled. But then also maybe to understand that it's a novel about loneliness and belonging and a search for human connection.
Well, the book is Hunger and Thirst. Claire Fuller, thank you so much for joining us again today.
It's been delightful. Thank you so much, Beth.
Hunger and Thirst by Claire Fuller was published by Tin House Zando. The music Claire listened to while writing Hunger and Thirst was titled The Winter of 1539 to 1540 by Goldmund. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.